Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And joining us today is my good friend, retired United States Air Force Lieutenant General Dave Deptula, the Dean of the Mitchell Institute for Aerospace Studies. He's also one of the world's leading air power minds and was one of the architects of the game-changing air campaign that 30 years ago on January 16 started dismantling Iraq's military capabilities during the first Gulf War. The 42-day air campaign paved the way for a lightning 100-hour ground war. Dave, happy belated New Year, and thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, thanks, Vago. It's great to have the opportunity to chat about this historic event, and particularly with you. You do such a good job.
Thanks very much. I really appreciate it, Dave, and it's always a pleasure having you on. I remember I started my journalism career roughly as the war was going on, and certainly in the aftermath as everybody was learning the lessons from that. You and retired General Chuck Horner, who led the air campaign, joined us last August as you guys recounted how you guys started planning in the wake of Iraq's invasion of Kuwait. It took through January of 1991 to complete the U.S. and allied buildup of air, land, and sea capabilities. And you were one of the key planners of this campaign. Obviously, Buster Glosson, John Warden were other luminaries in this extraordinary team that came together to do this. After thousands of hours of planning, you guys launched the campaign. Give us sort of your reminiscences of that day and what was going through your minds, and how you think about what happened over the past 30 years, maybe differently or the same.
Well, Vago, you got 4 or 5 hours?
Yes, we do. And I'm the host, so we can do that.
Actually, I give a four-hour presentation on, you know, just the unfolding of what happened in the stresses and all the different aspects. But I'll try to condense it as much as I can. You know, what I tell you and the audience is that the opening attacks of Desert Storm were a real radical departure in the conduct of warfare. That first 24-hour period, over 150 discrete targets. Now, that's in addition to regular Iraqi army forces and surface-to-air missile sites made up the master attack plan. Now, the coalition attacked more targets in Desert Storm's first day, then the entire 8th Air Force hit over the course of 2 years in World War II over Central Europe. In fact, never before in history had as many separate targets been attacked in less time than Desert Storm. Now, the results were paralysis, confusion, and rapid defeat of Saddam Hussein's gambit into Kuwait. And it's telling that when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, he possessed the fourth largest army in the world. When US and coalition forces concluded their operations, Saddam possessed the fourth largest army in Iraq. So this was really significant. You asked about kind of, you know, what was going on, just prior to the war. Well, you know, there were some new things that we had introduced here. This was the first major conflict that stealth in the form of the F-117 had a key role. So we were all anticipating how that was going to work out. And we were also concerned with the number of losses that we would incur because, you know, one's always concerned about that. And we had a lot going. So it kind of cut to the chase so we can get on to some other points that I'd like to make. We were just all ecstatic at the end of that first 24 hours when initially we had heard that we didn't lose one airplane. Well, it turns out that follow-on reporting revealed that we did lose one F-18, and that was a terrible thing. But you know, we were anticipating 25 to 35 airplane losses that first 24-hour period. So that was pretty spectacular. Desert Storm was a 43-day war in which air and space forces operated from the start to the finish. Every force was required. Ground forces, mainly in the form of the U.S. Army and the U.S. Marine Corps, acted as a blocking force against any Iraqi incursion into Saudi Arabia for almost the entire war, as aerospace forces attacked key enemy systems from above. I think it's important to recognize that the coalition only committed ground forces to reoccupy Kuwait in the final 4 days of the conflict. Now, all of this worked due to the training, technology investment, force structure, and procurement decisions that had been made in the 70s and early 80s. And it was the existence of that set of capabilities and capacity that enabled a plan that was based on achieving desired effects that really heralded the success of Desert Storm.
So let me tease that out a little bit, right? I mean, yeah. You mentioned stealth. The other one was unprecedented precision. Both of those were elements of the second offset strategy that were born in the wake of the Vietnam War and the heavy casualties we incurred there. And then on top of that, in 1986, you had Goldwater Nichols, right, to finally drive jointness throughout the force, especially in the wake of the Iran hostage debacle at the end of the day, when we really were not communicating with one another the way that we needed to. How did jointness, precision, timing, and navigation, right, in terms of GPS also, how did all of these elements really change warfare?
Well, there's a lot to unpack from that, Vago. Let me see if I can hit some of the key points. Desert Storm was, as you mentioned, the first major application of the construct of joint force operations created by the 86 Goldwater-Nichols Act. In Desert Storm, Army General Norman Schwarzkopf, the joint force commander, use the right forces at the right places at the right time, not little league rules where every service gets to play or fair share apportionment of tasks. And he came under a lot of pressure after the war, particularly from his brethren in the Army, because he led off with this extensive air campaign. But I got to tell you, Schwarzkopf had it right. I go back to using the right force, right place, right time. You know, in his mind, he went, well, why would I send ground forces headlong into the fourth largest army in the world, who'd just come out of 8 years of fighting the Iranians and duke it out in a mano-a-mano conflict where a lot of people's lives would get lost on both sides? So he did take a truly joint perspective. He goes, well, I got these air forces, and he trusted his commander, component commander, Chuck Horner. And then he established a sort of a metric. He said, I'm not gonna unleash the forces on the ground until we destroy at least 50% of the Iraqi forces deployed into Kuwait. Now that's pretty gutsy. Because if you go back and you look at Army doctrine, land force doctrine, generally they conclude that, you know, if you eliminate 10 to 15% of an adversary force, they're done, they're finished, they're over with. Schwarzkopf went for 50%. And I think the results play out. The fact of the matter is, by the time the service forces went into battle, I mean, it resulted in the great prisoner roundup. They had to go in, and they were necessary to reoccupy Kuwait. But, you know, the Iraqi army and their military had completely been negated and reduced to ineffectiveness by 39 days where there were no ground forces involved except for a small handful of soft dudes. But they were completely reduced as well as negated by air power.
How do you respond to those, especially in the Army, who maintain that actually that air power was sort of overrated in its ability to degrade, that units still had to go in there, and that the best way to kill another tank was with another tank, for example, or that well, that it was Army attack helicopters that had to open, albeit led by Air Force special operations helicopters, that had to, you know, take out radar towers to open up those strike corridors for stealth jets and others. How do you respond to
First, with the truth and with accuracy, what you just articulated is laughable because of its inaccuracy. I'll hit the last one first. Myself and a guy who at the time, Captain Randy O'Boyle, special operator, we're the ones that designed that attack. And it wasn't to open a corridor for stealth aircraft. That's absolute nonsense. Folklore in the Army is that. But, you know, when that attack came off, stealth aircraft were already deep inside Iraq. They didn't open a corridor for stealth aircraft. They opened a corridor for an F-15E strike package to allow it to get to the Scud sites that had launchers aimed at Israel, to be able to attack them simultaneously with the bombs going off in Baghdad. And in order to do that, we needed to suppress that early warning site 21 minutes prior to H hour to give the F-15Es time to penetrate that deep into Iraq. Those are the facts. With respect to, you know, having to fight the battles in Kuwait, listen, the Iraqi military was finished. They were surrendering to drones. You know, targeting drones from the battleships had been sent out over Kuwait, and you saw hundreds and hundreds of Iraqi army forces with white flags surrendering to the drone. My army friends tell me how they went 150 kilometers in one day in Iraq, and that was a record in history. My response is, well, so did French news reporters and Jeep Cherokees. So this was not to take away anything from the required use of land forces, the Army and Marines, because like I said, they were required. Everybody played, but they were a little bitter at the fact that air power was the principal force that was used exclusively in the first 90, not the first, but in the 90% of this entire operation. Now, let me expand on that a little bit, because this was the first time in history that the services provided components to a joint force commander who then orchestrated them in a unified fashion, instead of each service fighting their own segregated battles. And the people you're referring to still want to do that. You know, they view the Army as the queen of battle, and that's the only way anything can get done. But the beauty of a true joint force approach is that it presumes every conflict will be different. Accordingly, what's beautiful about our joint force construct is that a joint force commander can select among service and functional components to adjust different force mixes to meet the needs of a particular contingency. So that's what Schwarzkopf did here, and he was masterful, and perhaps I'd go so far to say as the best joint force commander that we've seen since Goldwater Nichols was enacted.
I also want to point out, right, that Chuck Horner pointed this out as well, right? I mean, he was an exceptionally highly decorated Air Force aviator and Wild Weasel crewman flying the F-105, the legendary Thunder Chief. And Norm Schwarzkopf had a tremendous and distinguished service in Vietnam. And both of them were shaped and colored by that, right? So Schwarzkopf was like, hey, whatever you air guys can do to set the conditions for my ground guys and me to not to lose too many people, go ahead and do that, which was, again, I mean, to your point of, you know, trying to use every instrument every tool in the toolbox to get the job done. I want to ask you, Dave, what are the lasting lessons from the conflict, right? The entire world went to school. There were doctrinal writings by the Russians as well as the Chinese saying, aha, lights go off, these guys have capabilities and we've got to figure out how to stymie each of these capabilities because God forbid they turn in on us. Now the precision revolution is universal. Other folks also have stealth capabilities. They're developing other novel capabilities. And any future fight, because of the fact that the precision universe will be turned against us in a future conflict at range, including with area denial capabilities and precision, right? What's applicable from and a lesson learned that remains from the Gulf, from the air campaign during the Gulf War? What does not, and what's different, and how do we have to adjust?
Well, again, Bago, there's a lot to unpack there. Let me hit on a couple of things that I think are extraordinarily important that are still relevant today, and then I'll wrap it up kind of with my takeaways from the overall experience, because I know we're running out of time here. Now, you alluded to it, but most people are aware of the impact of precision, but fewer are aware of the dramatic impact of stealth. So let me use an example to illustrate. This example involves the first non-stealthy attack on one target in the Basra area. That's a southeastern Iraq, Shaiba airfield to be exact. It was one target, that airfield. There were three aim points, and that was the hangars on the airfield. It consisted of four Navy A6s dropping bombs, along with four Saudi Tornado bomb droppers, five Marine EA-6Bs jamming acquisition radars, four Air Force F-4Gs taking out one type of surface-to-air missile system, 17 Navy F-18s taking out another, four F-18s as escort, and three drones to bring up enemy radars. Okay, that's 41 airplanes, eight of them dropping bombs on one target. Now, at about the same time, I've assigned 20 F-117s, all 20 dropping bombs on 38 aim points at 28 different targets. That's less than half the aircraft hitting over 1,200% the target base. That leverage equates to a stealth multiplier of around 19. Or put another way, it took 19 stealth aircraft to accomplish the effect of one stealth aircraft in this particular circumstance. So I think you can see there that there's enormous leverage. A matter of fact, it's that kind of a leverage that allowed 36 F-117 aircraft in the first 24 hours of Desert Storm to attack more targets than the entire non-stealth, non-precision air and missile force of the six aircraft carriers in the theater. You know, when we got to the end of the war, the stats are that the stealthy F-117s equipped with PGMs, precision-guided munitions, struck over 40% of Iraq's fixed targets, despite only flying 2% of the combat sorties. That's the value that stealth brings. And it's still relevant today. The other one is this notion of effects-based targeting, which, you know, it's not as sexy as precision or stealth or night vision goggles or cruise missiles, but it had an enormous impact. And I want to share with you just a little story of how this notion of effects-based planning and execution was born. You alluded to it, and most people know that the offensive air campaign planning process began in the basement of the Pentagon in right after Saddam invaded Kuwait in August of 90. It was in the places of an air staff division known as Checkmate, and while we discussed the virtues of effects-based planning there before, the initial attack plans were developed on the basis of traditional destruction-based methodologies. And here's what happened. Early on, the intel folks told us there were two major sector operation centers that controlled Iraqi defenses, one in Baghdad and one at a place called Talil Air Base in southern Iraq. These were hardened structures designed to withstand a nuclear attack by the Iranians. And there were two bunkers in the basement of each. Now, the intel folks and the F-117 weapons officers figured it would take a combination of eight GBU-27s and GBU-10s per bunker. That's four each. Those are 2,000-pound munitions. directly placed one on another to dig down to reach the clusters or the command bunkers. That's 16 weapons per air operations center to destroy them. But at the time, we only had 16 F-117s designated for planning use. So killing both bunkers require in each operation center required that we use up all our 117s in the original attack plan. But it was worth it if we could poke out their eyes and cover their ears. Now, let me jump 2 weeks ahead. In late August 1990, we're furiously working to turn the master attack plan into an air tasking order in Riyadh for General Horner. And on the 30th of August, General Glossin and I fly to Manama, Bahrain to brief Admiral Maz. At the time, he was the commander of all naval forces in the Gulf. And you have to realize, people say, well, why'd you fly there? Why didn't you just send it to him? Because this plan was so highly compartmented and classified, and we didn't have the bandwidth that you could, and frankly, Horner didn't want to put any of this on electrons. So we went down there to brief him. And after we completed the brief, as we're taking off out of Bahrain, the C-21 that we're in fills up with smoke. There was a fire behind the instrument panel. The pilot declares an emergency and we return to Bahrain. So while we're waiting on another airplane to come get us, I pull out this intel study that I requested describing the Iraqi air defense system to get more familiar with it, because up until then, I just took them at their word. But as I'm reading this document, I find out that there aren't just two air operation centers in Iraq, there are four of them. And that associated with each one of them are 3 to 5 sub-centers, each one of which can pick up control. It's a network. Now, right, as you might expect, this dramatically changed the target planning problem, how to paralyze their air defense system in one blow. So what to do? I want to achieve as much impact across the entire target base as possible to achieve a debilitating effect so we can get our non-stealthy aircraft in ingress successfully. But I don't have enough airplanes, F-117s, to do that. So the next day in Riyadh, while I'm sitting in our small planning room, the black hole, I postulated that a 2,000-pound bomb could go off on the other end of the building we were in. And while we wouldn't be dead, we sure as hell wouldn't hang around to finish our coffee. So we didn't need to destroy each air operation center the first night. We only needed to render it ineffective. So I rewrote the attack plan, not putting 8 F-117s on each air operation center, but rather one bomb on each one of these. And in some cases, I put two because of their importance. But what that did was it freed up 30 GBU 10s and 27s to use against the other targets, namely the other interceptor operation centers. And that was the birth of this kind of effects-based approach that I use in developing the daily attack plans for the entirety of the campaign and for every target set.
But if I can ask, right, from a broader perspective, right, what are the lessons that are still applicable? What are the lessons that are not? And how has and is air power changing in the face of these threats?
Yeah, no, okay, let me wrap up concisely. Desert Storm really established the character of modern warfare. It was a turning point for a couple of reasons. First, it foretold precision in the application of force for all future conflicts. In Desert Storm, 5 to 8% of the weapons were precision-guided munitions. In Operation Inherent Resolve, or operations in Syria, 99% of all the weapons employed were precision. Get the message? Kind of a big change there. Second, the operation demonstrated the success of using desired effects as the focus of strategy in the planning and conduct of operations. And what we do need to move away from, and I talked about inherent resolve, that is not how to run a modern war. What happened in Syria was because of the previous 10 to 15 years of operations and counterinsurgency ops in Afghanistan and Iraq, CENTCOM just took the same playbook and applied it against the Islamic State. But the Islamic State was not an insurgency. It was a proto-state, and it had right. We had the ability to take it apart dramatically very early on. and crush their ability to operate. And we could have done that in 4 months, not 4 years. Back to Desert Storm. It set the expectation for low casualties on both sides of a conflict. And you see that. As a matter of fact, to our detriment, during Inherent Resolve, you know, I asked some questions about the target development process out at the CAOC, the Air Operations Center. The response I got back was, well, sir, sometimes it takes up to 46 to 50 days to fully vet a target. You know, and think about it, 46 to 50 days. The entirety of Desert Storm was over in 43 days. What are you doing? Because of this focus on, you know, immaculate warfare, which is unobtainium, people are forgetting that the best way and the most rapid way of preventing unintentional civilian casualties is to terminate the adversary who is doing and accomplishing those travesties as rapidly as possible. Desert Storm introduced the prosecution of a joint air campaign integrating all service air operations under the functional command of an airman. That's extraordinarily important because instead of having five separate air wars as occurred in Vietnam, Chuck Horner and Norman Schwarzkopf, who supported him, if you're not on the ATO, you're not flying. In other words, if you're not part of this integrated plan, you're not going to fly. Now, there are many instances, because this was pretty new, particularly in the Marine Corps, they attempted to go around that guidance and go off and do their own thing. But we had so many assets, so many aircraft, that we could accomplish our missions regardless. And then finally, in terms of major takeaways, for the first time in history, air power was used as the key force in the strategy and execution of a war. Now, in the very beginning, you talked about how, you know, the Army and the other services resisted that. Well, sure they did. But it goes back to what I said about joint force operations. And as I have gotten more and more senior, I'm more and more a fan because the true construct of joint operations allows us a true joint force commander will look at the other services and say, you know, soldier, sailor, airman, marine, space guardian, you tell me what you can bring to this fight that we can together accomplish our objectives. It doesn't mean that there's always going to be a single playbook. It allows us to adapt to the particular contingency, and all of them are going to be different.
Let me ask you two quick questions before we part. Today's the last full day of the Trump administration. Tomorrow, the Biden administration is coming in. Give us your sense on the legacy of the Trump administration insofar as the Air Force is concerned. Obviously, Space Force, the administration counts as an achievement, although you're somewhat less of a fan of that. You know, give us your sense on the outgoing administration's legacy, and then what do you think the priorities need to be for an incoming Biden administration?
Well, first, Vago, one of the issues that all Americans should be very proud of is that the U.S. military exists to assure the security of the American people, all of the American people, regardless of political affiliation. Each military person takes an oath to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States. So I want to be real careful here as the moves to enhance the U.S. military under the Trump administration should not be dismissed simply because they occurred during his time in office. What is key to your question is the state of national security, not politics. Now, all that said, the bottom line is that the Air Force today is the smallest and oldest it's ever been in its history. It was a geriatric Air Force when Trump came into office, and it remains so today. The youngest B-52 is over 58 years old. The Air Force is flying tankers and trainers over 50 years old and fighters over 30 years old. So the Air Force is facing immense pressures to modernize and recapitalize its force. Yet the Air Force has absorbed the largest budget cuts of all the services following the Cold War. That needs to be reversed. Now, the Air Force has laid out a goal that is necessary to meet the needs of the National Defense Strategy, 386 operational squadrons, and they should not back away from that because it's an objective evaluation of what's actually needed. And just because we can't, quote, afford that right now, and we only have 315 operational squadrons, or 25, is a measure of the risk that we're taking. Now, let me shift. The Biden defense team picks that are announced to date, they're solid and they'll be effective advocates for a strong defense. That said, the budget allocated to defense by Biden's OMB and that will be approved by the new Congress is for sure going to be lower than current levels. That's of great concern to both the Air Force and the Space Force because they both face daunting demands. There's two key actions that can provide the new Biden administration some solutions in an era where these defense budget cuts are going to become reality. First, even in the face of decreased funding, the Department of Defense can achieve greater capability if it begins to evaluate programs in a cost per effect assessment manner. What does that mean? That means judging programs based on how they accomplish mission objectives, not simply unit and sustainment costs. I kind of gave you an example when I talked about the value of stealth, that one stealth aircraft could perform the mission that it would take 19 non-stealth aircraft to conduct. So while individually on a unit cost basis, it might be more expensive, it's an order of magnitude less expensive than doing the job any other way. All right, the second point that, you know, I'd encourage the Biden administration to come up with or take is money over which the Air Force has no control must be separated from its budget to ensure accurate understanding of its actual budget. Now, this money is called pass-through. This is a little detailed, but just to show you how much this is shielded, but it amounts to about 20% of the total Air Force budget. It was $39.2 billion in 2020, and it takes up 45% of the Air Force procurement accounts. This money goes to the intelligence community, and the Air Force has absolutely no control over it. So the negative effect of pass-through funding is real, and it must be stopped to ensure transparency in defense spending. And I know we're short on time, but with respect to the Space Force, it was obviously stood up under the Trump administration. But currently, the Space Force is underfunded, undermanned, and does not have the authorities for which it was stood up for to consolidate those 60 other organizations that have a say in space. Now, none of these areas have increased beyond what they were when the Space Force was Air Force Space Command. This is going to be a big challenge for the Biden administration, because if they increase resources for the Space Force while decreasing the overall defense top line, some other service is going to get hit and hit hard. But now that the Space Force has stood up, we need to ensure its success. And that means funding it, manning it, and consolidating all those other organizations out there that have a role in space underneath the Space Force.
There is one question I want to get your take on, Dave, which is how the Air Force's confidence after the Gulf War may actually have dampened the enthusiasm of subsequent generations of airmen to as effectively tell their story in the competition of resources. Does the Air Force have to do better?
Unfortunately, since the removal of the Chief of Staff of the Air Force and the Secretary of the Air Force simultaneously by Secretary Gates, the message that sent to the Air Force writ large was you better not speak truth to power, because if you do, and I don't like what you're going to say, I don't like what you say, I'm going to put a bullet between your eyes. Now, I'm not saying that was decision was made with that intent, with malice aforethought, because I don't think it was, but it is an actual consequence of what happened. And so the Air Force, since the removal of General Mosley and Secretary Wynn, kind of went into a go-along-to-get-along mode. And that needs to reverse, and here's why. because it's not joint. Jointness means that if you are a service leader, it is your responsibility to advocate and articulate for the virtues of your service. Because if you don't, nobody else will. And the joint force commanders out there who actually do the war fighting will not be aware of your capabilities. So jointness requires advocacy. And I would expect that each one of the service leaders do that. That's their job. Your role as a joint task force commander is very, very different. Because what you're looking for, as I relayed that General Schwarzkopf did, was, gosh, what are the right forces to be used at the right places at the right times and putting together an actual war plan that capitalizes on all U.S. military service advantages and capabilities to defeat an adversary? Okay, that's one answer. Now, the second answer with respect to aerospace forces writ large, there is no, zero, nada, no U.S. joint force operation that can be conducted without some element of the Department of the Air Force. Okay, aerospace forces have become the indispensable force in the conduct of joint force operations. Okay, whether it's communications, whether it's intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, whether it's power projection, whether it's transportation, whether it's command and control, no joint force operation can be conducted without the Department of the Air Force. And you cannot say that about any of the other individual services. So I think that's important to digest.
Sir, thanks very much for joining us. Always a pleasure.
You bet, Vago. You have a great aerospace power kind of day.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.